The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 6.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Well, folks, we've got a great episode for you today. I talk with Stephen Landsberg, the economist. Among his other credentials, he's the author, and this is how I know him, he's the author of The Armchair Economist. And this was it's a wonderful book that came out. I was in undergrad when it was introduced to me. That I remember Lee Kopic was my intermediate micro professor, and he handed it to me and said, hey, you're going to love this book. And he was right. I think I was actually reading it at one point after we graduated, and another guy who was more of a cool cat from the school saw me reading. He's like, what are you reading that for? And I kind of got a little bit defensive because I find it interesting. I don't need to explain myself to you reading economics books. Anyway, folks, it's a great book if you haven't checked it out, especially if you are steeped in the Austrian tradition and you've read all your Rothbard and some Mises, maybe a little bit of Hayek here and there. I'm telling you, if you haven't read Steve Landsberg, you need to, just to get a sense of the power of the Chicago school price theory tradition. And that will come up a little bit in the conversation that Steve and I will have, so you'll see what I'm talking about. But it's not to say that it's better than the Austrians, of course. I'm an Austrian myself. But it is just, you should be aware of it if you haven't really heard or read a practitioner of that really explain it. And also, it's not the same as like reading Milton Friedman's Free to Choose. If you're thinking, oh yeah, I've read the Chicago School, I've read a bunch of Friedman's. And Steve might not even agree with me if you heard me say this, but it's something different. So just by all means, check out Steve's latest book, which he's going to talk about in the interview, but also the one that put him on my map was The Armchair Economist. So more formally, the introduction for our guest, Stephen E. Landsberg is a professor of economics at the University of Rochester. His books for the general public include The Armchair Economist, Fair Play, More Sex is Safer Sex, The Big Questions, and most recently, Can You Outsmart an Economist? 100 Plus Puzzles to Train Your Brain. For many years, Steve wrote regularly for Forbes and Slate and occasionally for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. And he blogs at www.thebigquestions.com. Without further ado, here is my very interesting, I hope you'll agree, interview with Steve Landsberg. Well, Steve, glad to have you here on episode 6 of the Bob Murphy Show.
Bob, it's a real, real pleasure to be here.
So there's lots of possible things we can talk about, and I am hoping over the years as this podcast grows and I become internationally famous that I have you back on many times. But for this opening one, let me just hit some of the main obvious ideas. And first, as I've done with plenty of the other people who I think would be known to my listeners, and I'm sure, of course, the ones with an economics background are familiar with you, but let's go back to the beginning. So I'm just curious, at what point in your life did you know you wanted to end up being a college professor, you know, working in the life of academia?
I think I realized that long before I knew what a college professor was. I remember as a child feeling a real compulsion to have an interesting life, to have a life of ideas. I remember sitting at the dinner table and hearing the adults talk about things that struck me as terribly boring. In particular, they were always talking about the quality of the food and how the food compared to the food we had last time and who likes mayonnaise and who doesn't like mayonnaise. And I remember thinking as a very young child, when I'm grown up, I'm going to have more interesting things to talk about than that. And so I started at a very early age looking for a way to do that.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to be somebody who spent his time thinking about something interesting.
Okay. And so when you were like a little, like when you're 7 years old, you're looking to say, man, the grown-ups, these grown-ups are real boring. I'm going to be an interesting grown-up. Or like when you were 13.
That is my I have a very strong memory of that. Now, I also know enough about human memory to know that a lot of the things we think we remember are not at all as they were. But I have a very strong memory at age 7 of sitting there thinking, oh, God, these people are boring. I am not going to be like them.
Well, that is interesting because I remember, yeah, like showing up. I'm sure everybody identifies this. When your parents drag you to some event, you show up. And then you see there's other kids there. And then all of a sudden you light up because the kids are fun. It's the grownups. Oh, my gosh. They just stand around drinking wine and talk, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, I never thought at the time, oh, wow, if I could just, you know, learn about capital theory, that would be exciting. All right.
I didn't know it was going to be capital theory, but I knew it was going to be something. I knew there were ideas out there that were going to be fun to think about, and all I had to do was find them.
There's more to life than is this meatloaf done. All right. That's good. Well, so then I know, and maybe you could just tell a little bit of the more of the details. So you originally were going into math, and then I think that's even what your grad work was in. And then, but of course, most people probably know you as, oh yeah, he's that great economist. So how can you explain that transition?
Well, I don't know if they know me as that great economist. They may might know
that's
me
how
as,
I think of you.
As somebody who writes about economics. I went to grad school in math, and math is my first love. And if I had to choose between math and economics as the only thing I could ever think about, I'm afraid it would be math. But I've had the great good fortune of being able to think about both. And I got a PhD in math. I have done research in math. I've got quite a few journal articles in math, and I continue to think about math. At the same time, I discovered in graduate school by meeting a bunch of friends who were economics majors that economics was really, really cool also. And these people were so passionate and so excited about what they were learning, and they were always telling me about what they had just learned in class, and it sounded so fascinating that I felt like I needed to know about that too. And I picked that up mostly over the dinner table and over the lunch table with my economics friends.
Okay, well, I've jotted down a few notes here just in response to what you said there, because there's different angles I want to take this, so hopefully we don't get lost. But you might even know this anecdote. I don't know if you can say, yes, this really happened, or it's just a legend that grew up. But there was some guy on his deathbed, and he was in the world of ideas and math and physics. And then the story goes, his students wanted to see whether he was actually a mathematician or a physicist. And so they went up to him and they told him the famous problem of, you know, there's two trains, you know, one's going north at 50 miles an hour and the other one's going south at 50 miles an hour, and the bird's going back and forth between them. And then it's, you know, how much total distance has the bird traversed before the trains pass each other? And so the idea is if he solves it real fast, he's a physicist, because then he just sees the trick and realizes, oh, I just figure out what's the speed of the bird, how much time elapses when the trains cross each other, and then I just multiply. And that's real simple. It's, you know, whatever, it's 100 miles or something. And the guy spits the answer out super fast. And so his students say, ah, he thinks like a physicist, not like a mathematician. And they said, you saw the trick. And he says, what trick? And he had done like the infinite series in his head of the bird going to the one train, the turnaround, and like the distance kept shrinking. Do you know that anecdote, or is that
story is often told about John von Neumann. In the version I've heard, he's not on his deathbed, but some version of it is often told about John von Neumann.
Well, at some point he was on his deathbed, I think, right?
At some point, and far too young too. He died very young. But von Neumann was one of the fastest thinkers in mathematical history, probably in world history. So it's a plausible anecdote. Mm-hmm. In fact, it has been said by me, and I think by others as well, that von Neumann is a really good example of somebody who might have done even better work if he had been a little less intelligent, because he was so smart that he was able always to do these incredibly complicated calculations in his head and get to the answer. And therefore, unlike other people, he was not forced to think about finding the tricks that would illuminate the issue so that you wouldn't have to do all those hard computations. He was so good at doing the hard stuff, he never had to try and find the easy way, whereas finding the easy way is often the way science progresses. So he made huge contributions, fantastic contributions to math and physics and economics. But maybe if he'd had 5 points less IQ, he would have done even better.
I'm going to say that about myself from now on. I would have had even more contributions if I hadn't been so darn intelligent. Well, so the reason I brought that up was, so again, just in case I zoomed through that too quickly for the listeners. So the idea there being that the physicist likes to like see the intuitive shortcut and figure out what the trick is to think about something that's difficult, to reduce a really hard problem to something easier. to then solve it, whereas the mathematician just attacks the problem with brute force.
Yeah, I don't buy that at all. I think mathematicians love finding those tricks. Neumann was perhaps the rare example who did not see the need to find the tricks, but mathematicians love finding tricks like that.
All right, well, that's interesting that you're disputing, you know, the folk wisdom or the folklore there. But the reason I was bringing it up is I was saying I've noticed that in certain economics problems, it seems like the example I have in mind, and maybe you see this coming, Steve, is when we were arguing about does debt burden our grandchildren, and Paul Krugman had brought it up, Dean Baker originally brought it up, and this people who have been following my work can see this. I'll put links again. So this is, folks, bobmurphyshow.com/6 is where you're going to get all the links for everything Steve and I are talking about today. And so here's my version of what happened, Steve, is that Krugman said something that he said, oh, yes, it is. You can't have that the government's debt burdens our grandchildren so long as they owe it to themselves. And I said, oh, no, there's a fallacy involved there. And you were sort of above the fray, as I thought, because you had never fallen for this is, again, my version of events that you were sort of defending Krugman's conclusion. And I stepped back and looked at your argument. I was like, no, Steve, you're thinking like this, like a mathematician. And so you never got the problem wrong, whereas Krugman was relying on faulty intuition. And then I pointed out, and the reason I thought I saw that in him was because that I myself had been using the wrong intuition for a few years and then realized the mistake involved. Whereas my claim was you weren't relying on, you know, an intuitive shortcut that ended up actually being wrong. It wasn't a shortcut. It was a dead end. And so that's why you never fell prey to that. So the way I summarized that was, Steve was, solving it the right way using like finance or mathematics, whereas we were trying to be cute using economic intuition and we just blew up on our faces. So I'm guessing you're going to disagree with that narrative.
I'm going to be totally honest with you, Bob. I hate to say it, but I don't remember the details of that discussion. I do vividly remember the discussion. I remember it being illuminating. I remember it being fun. And I remember you had lots of numerical examples that were well worth attention and well worth working through. But I don't remember the details of who said what when.
Well, then I think I automatically win. Then we just move on. We can put a little asterisk.
I'm happy to concede that.
But again, just for the folks at home, and I'll link this, but again, my point was it was ironic that it wasn't that I ever thought Steve did anything wrong in the debate. It's that I thought was being too generous to Krugman. It's like, oh no, what Krugman's trying to say is such, and Steve gave a perfectly correct sense in which government debt doesn't burden grandchildren because the way Steve was looking at it, it's like, oh no, it's just tax and transfer payments and da da da. And I was like, yeah, Steve, you're right. If that's what Krugman had said, I would have been fine, but that's not the argument he used.
So I think what you're saying, and this more or less jibes with my memory, I think what you're saying is that Krugman had reached a defensible conclusion via an indefensible argument.
Yeah.
And that I defended him because I looked at his conclusion and I didn't really read his argument. So I didn't realize that he had gotten to the defensible conclusion in an indefensible way. And therefore, I inappropriately defended him.
Right. And I think psychologically, because you're no stranger to criticizing Krugman. It's not, and I think you weren't, quote, seeing it because just from step one, you had never fallen prey to the seductive shortcut that actually was not a good idea.
Could be.
So that's what I think happened. All right. Well, if you're not going to challenge that, good. I guess, are there any examples you can see like that where you, and maybe your answer will be you think this dichotomy is actually not helpful, but I'm wondering, are there situations where you see other economists tackling something, but like perhaps it looks to you familiar to maybe a math puzzle or something, and you're the one to see the answer that then everybody agrees with first, because of your background starting in math as opposed to you were, in economics the whole time. Has anything like that ever happened?
I think there have been times, certainly, sitting around the lunch table, not a whole lot of times, but there have been times when I've had an insight that nobody else at the table had, and sometimes an insight that people were skeptical of that they ended up agreeing with. But, is that because of my background in math? I have no idea. And I think what you're saying is that it's not what you're suggesting that is that it's not so much my background in math as my lack of a background in economics, that by having not been formally trained in economics, I was not exposed to some of the wrong ways of thinking that people fall into when they're studying economics. And so I had maybe managed to avoid a trap that other people had fallen into. I'm not prepared with any specific examples. I don't know. I certainly don't think that there is any case in which a very sophisticated understanding of mathematics has made me understand economics better than anybody else at the table. That just doesn't happen. To understand economics, you need to understand economics. You're not going to get there just purely through formal mathematics.
Okay, let me give one other anecdote just to motivate that. I remember Roger Garrison, and I'm paraphrasing, this might not be an exact quote, but he said to me, or maybe he's put it in print also, that he started out with an engineering background, and he thought that that gave him a leg up in the capital theory, like the Cambridge capital controversy and stuff like that, because engineers had to always think in terms of units. And he was saying, whereas a lot of economists, he would note, would jump into something and, you know, they wouldn't even have their units right. And, you know, you're being quick and sloppy and it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme, but on real fundamental theoretical issues that are kind of deep and abstract, his point was that no, that capital theory was a case where he really did disagree, you know, fundamentally with how some of his peers were attacking it. And he did say he thought that his engineering background, again, just for something as simple as when you write out an equation, you got to make sure that the units all match up on, you know, the different sides of the equation and that sort of thing. He thought that that actually gave him a leg up for economists who were never taught, you know, at the AP level in high school, hey, make sure your units all match up, you know, something real simple like that.
Well, maybe, but I mean, as you know, Bob, you and I have been emailing a little about an economic issue just over the last couple of days, and I've been scribbling down some equations trying to understand it better. And as a matter of fact, just yesterday, I saved myself from a major error by checking the units on both sides of my equation. So that very thing did pay off for me within the last 24 hours.
Well, all right. Well, I jotted up. We're going to come back to that too, as this conversation unfolds, because that is something I wanted, because I think people would be interested to know, like, yeah, just when you know, how do economists, you come up with some paper or something? How's that happening? And here in real time, you and I did have that. But let's, before we lose the train of thought here, I do want to come back to, so you were at Chicago. That's where you were doing your work in math. And that's where you were at the lunch table encountering your friends that were taking economics courses?
Yeah, and, you know, Chicago at that time was, in many ways, the most exciting place in the world to do math and the most exciting place in the world to do economics. It was a wonderful confluence of intellectual magnificence. And, you know, I was surrounded by people who were doing brilliant things and were excited about what they were doing. It was a very heady time.
So can you give the listener, like, who are some of the big guns in economics that were there while you were there?
The big guns in economics while I was there were Milton Friedman, George Stigler, Dee McCluskey, Gary Becker, Bob Lucas, and, you know, many, many others. I mean, I've left a few Nobel Prize winners off that list, but those were the ones who were most visible to me and the ones who I think were most out front in terms of what the economics students were seeing. I ended up knowing and interacting with most of those people. Over the course of my life, I had maybe four lengthy conversations with Milton. Stigler I knew better, McCluskey even better than that. I talked to Lucas a lot. Again, it was very, to me, as a person coming from outside economics, the fact that these people were willing to talk to me and spend time with me and interact was very exciting and inspiring.
So obviously the people, you know, listening to this podcast presumably know those names, but I'm wondering, before you showed up at Chicago, did those names mean it? Like, did you know who Milton Friedman was? And I'm wondering which down that list, like, had you heard of those people? Were they famous?
I'm sure that I knew who Milton Friedman was. I probably did not know who Dee McCluskey was. Becker, Stigler, I'm not sure. I mean, I had some friends in college who were economics majors, and I might have heard them talking about them. Friedman was pretty much a public figure at that point.
Sure,
so anybody with any interest in public affairs was very aware of who Friedman was. He was all over the news. He had his column in Newsweek. He was doing television shows, writing best-selling books. So that was an easy name to be aware of. Stigler and Becker might have been a little more obscure. I'm not sure.
So I'm curious, like, did you sit in on, like, would some outside person come and present a paper at Chicago, and would Friedman and Becker and all those people be around the table just offering comments on the paper?
Offering comments is a kind way of saying it.
Yeah.
There is a tradition at Chicago of being very brutal in those workshops that we at Chicago and in many economics departments. We call them workshops, not seminars. Friedman, I think, was the inventor of the tradition where everybody is assumed to have read the paper in advance. And you sit down at the table, and instead of giving the speaker a chance to present his paper, you start off with the leader of the workshop, in this case, Friedman himself, asking, are there any comments on page one? And then, are there any comments on page two? And so on through the paper as far as you could get, although you often didn't get very far because the comments on some of the even early pages led to so much discussion and so much back and forth that you didn't get very far. That was, I think, a real innovation in a new technology for academic progress, and it became traditional at Chicago, and it was very hard on some of the outsiders who came in expecting to be able to present their ideas and finding they couldn't get a word in edgewise. I do remember one case, I'm not going to tell you who it was, but a full professor from an Ivy League university who was literally reduced to tears by the criticism that he got. And it was very valid criticism, too. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure he had the best possible response to it.
There's no crying in economics. Well, I never heard that the level of detail about the page one, page two. So every seminar he would do that? He would say
every page seminar one, page he would two? Do that. Are there any comments on page one? Now, on one occasion, I remember the Friedman apparently had not looked carefully at the paper because page one had no content. Page one was just a brief thank you to somebody else who happened to be in the room. And when Friedman asked, are there any comments on page one, that person raised his hand and said, yes, take my name off this. I don't want it on this paper. that was an inauspicious start.
Wow. Yeah, you guys did sound pretty brutal. Yeah, I went to NYU and I remember there was the lore. And there was one guy, our micro professor, who was just the most anal retentive guy. I mean, it was great. I'm saying this as a compliment. Like, you know, you'd make some offhand statement and he would correct you, you know, and you know, be like, no, there could be, you know, countably infinite, or something about countably infinite sets. I remember I made a joke and he corrected my math about the, you know, it was a harmless joke. And he had to weigh in to tell me that I had gotten something with the measure theory wrong in my joke. But apparently, there was somebody presenting, and early on, this guy Chuck Wilson raised his hand and said, yeah, but you know, you define this like this, and then, but this is like this, and so there's a problem here with this first proof. And the guy was just looking at him and just said, oh yes, you're right, and just like collected his papers and just said, I'm terribly sorry, and just left the room.
who was that?
I don't know.
The professor. Who was the micro professor?
The guy who made the comment? Yeah. Charles Wilson.
Ah.
Yeah, he was like my first year. He taught the... Was the first? He's either first or second semester. I'm getting mixed up now. At micro, and so yeah. So, do you think that was the optimal level? Because I have to be honest, there were other times when I would watch. It wasn't so much at the Austrian colloquium. So we had the Austrian colloquium there that Mario Rizzo ran, and Israel Kirzner was there. You know, when he was still going to those. And there, it could be hostility, but it was more, you know, you were the guest and you were coming to present and it was supposed to just be a nice discussion. Whereas the more just the regular econ department, their workshops, yeah, were more brutal. But I did to me, it looked like some of the people were just kind of showing off for the crowd. Whereas the guys that I thought were like the best, like the smartest, deepest thinkers on, you know, at NYU on the faculty, it seemed like they were more... You know, if they saw a problem, they would point it out to them, but they were more like asking questions, like to learn, like, well, why did you make this assumption? Oh, okay. You know, that. And so anyway, I'm wondering, is it?
There was a small amount of showboating. I think probably Stigler was the most guilty of that because Stigler was an incredibly witty man, and he would never pass up an opportunity to be funny, even if it was entirely unfair. Also, my sense overall was that for all the brutality, I'll use that word, it was all done in the spirit of trying to understand the issues better. Mm-hmm. And people who came on very strong and very brutal were invariably quick to back down if they were shown to be wrong. Again, I'm going to say, and it's a little unfair since he's dead and can't defend himself, but Stigler may have been an exception to that. I think he was not always entirely intellectually fair in those conversations. But the others were, and the most legendary example of that was the seminar where Coase came and presented his paper on the Coase theorem. It was the first time he had presented it in an academic workshop, and there were in the room at the time, I think, seven future Nobel Prize winners. And they took a vote at the beginning on how many people thought that the paper was essentially correct. This was the paper that Coase wrote on social cost, which eventually won him a Nobel Prize and changed the way economists think about externalities, which is a huge topic. They took a vote on whether the paper was essentially correct. The vote came out 13-1 against. And when Stigler recounted the story afterwards, he said it would have been even more lopsided if we hadn't allowed Coase to vote. But as I was not there, this was a little before my time, but I have heard the story from many people who were there, and they all tell more or less the same story. They all thought he was wrong. They pulled no punches in letting him know how very wrong they thought he was. He stood his ground, and at some point, and they went way over time. This was a scheduled to go an hour and a half, and they just kept going and kept going and kept going. And at some point, Milton Friedman, who had been one of the harshest critics, spoke up and said, actually, now that I've been thinking about it, I think that on this one point here, he's actually right. And somebody else said, well, I was just thinking on this one other point, he might actually be right. And before long, the room came around to the view that everything in the paper was not only right, it was pathbreaking, and it was revolutionary, and it was important, and it was stuff of historical importance. And the seminar, which had begun at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, ended at 2 a.m. after a change of venue from the seminar room to Aaron Director's living room down the street. So, there's an example of where the speaker came under very, very heavy fire, but he was right. And because he was right, he converted the audience eventually.
So the lesson then is just as long as you write a paper like The Problem of Social Cost, you're fine.
I guess so. There is interesting. There's a lot, if in that paper, Coase covers two cases. He covers first the sort of benchmark case where there are no transaction costs, what economists call transaction costs. That means that it's easy for everybody to negotiate with each other costlessly. And he thinks through the problem of externalities in that case, and then he thinks through it again in the case where there are substantial barriers to negotiation. And in both cases, he had revolutionary things to say. But interestingly, among the people who were there, there's a great deal of dispute about which part surprised them more. Stigler always insisted it was the no transactions cost case that had everybody in the room agape with surprise. Other people who were there say, no, that part didn't surprise anybody. It was the other half that surprised us. So, I guess unless somebody discovers a hidden audio tape, that will never be settled.
Now, what's funny, I'm glad you explained it that way, because I have this weird thing where I've had to read that paper several times in preparation, to teach it in a history of thought class or for Tom Wood's Liberty classroom. I covered the Coase theorem and, so I went into all that. And every time I reread that paper, I have the same experience where it's a difficult paper to get through. But then once I'm done and I take the principles away, I'm almost worried that if I said it to somebody, even to undergrads, they're going to say, well, that's so obvious. Tell me something new or tell me, you know what I mean? I don't know if I'm getting myself across here.
Absolutely.
Steve,
but, yeah. And I agree with you 100%. I was going to say 1,000%, but we both know that that's ludicrous. It's an incredibly unnecessarily difficult paper to read. And in my view, the reason for that is that the guy has 5 or 6 points that he wants to make, two of which are major and another 3 or 4 of which are important. And he illustrates them with examples, but he's often very unclear about which example is intended to illustrate which point. And he kind of rambles and he makes one point and he makes another point and he throws out an example and he makes another point and he throws out another example. And it's never clear exactly what he's trying to illustrate. And if you read it and digest it, eventually you see that what the points are and how each of them is illustrated here and there by examples that are scattered around. But in my view, it's a pretty disorganized paper. And it's also true that when you digest the ideas in that paper and state them, it becomes impossible to imagine a world in which this was not obvious to everybody. But it is absolutely the case that nobody realized any of this stuff until Coase pointed it out. It's also true that it is absolutely obvious once you say it. And man, that's the best kind of idea there is. I'll say too, every year I teach a course called Topics in Microeconomics, which is taken only by our very strongest students. And every year in that class, I assign the students to read Coase's paper and rewrite the paper in a version no more than 3 pages long. The original is about 60 pages. They're required to rewrite the paper, retaining all of the major ideas, and to say it in 3 pages and to organize it better than Coase organized it. And they do a great job with that. There are a lot of 3-page versions of that paper floating around that have been written by my students, which I think would be a better thing to read than the original paper itself.
That's a great idea. And I'm guessing those particular students know the Coase theorem better than anybody on earth because they did that.
I think they do. I think they do. And I think they learn a lot from that exercise. And, you know, it's a course where they do a lot of very technical mathematical work, too. And so it's a nice little change of pace for them.
And of course, as mathematicians, we know that really what my statement should have been is they know the Coase theorem at least as well as anyone else on earth. Let's see. So, by the way, before we move on, I just wanted to clarify, and I think you hit all the bases there with your answer, Steve. But yeah, I actually wasn't trying to say, man, what's the story? This guy can't write a paper. He's so disorganized. What I meant was the second thing you stressed was that once you get what he's saying, it's hard for you to not. It's like when you see a 3D cube or something, you can't not see it anymore. It can't just look like lines. And it was the same kind of thing where it's when you see the flaws in the conventional Pigouvian analysis and he shows you ways to think about it, it's like, oh, yeah, geez. But still, for someone who hasn't been exposed to that paradigm, it's so clear that, well, yeah, there's this negative externality over here and you got to put a tax on it, duh, and that's optimal. And so anyway, it really is amazing. And even sometimes I'll forget, like it's hard to reconstruct to show like an example where the numbers are all internally consistent, where levying a negative, you know, a Pigouvian tax to fix a negative externality in a standard framework would lead to a Pareto inefficient outcome. Like you can, you know, come up with examples where that's true, but it's kind of hard to get the thing to work and to be internally consistent. And yet, you know, I think that's one of the major things that in Coase's paper doesn't happen until like page 40 or something.
Right.
So we've talked about the culture at Chicago in terms of the perhaps brutal but fair and ultimately it served a social function workshop environment. But there's also, I think, a lot of us who hear stories, and I remember you've blogged about this, Steve, about like the lunch discussions and things like that. It wasn't just, you certainly weren't talking about the quality of the food. That's you avoided your childhood fate. You know, you didn't grow up into an adult that talks about the food. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what do you mean by, you know, what you guys would talk about at lunch? And you've carried it over now to your current job as well, right?
Lunch at Chicago every day was just an intellectual roller coaster. People were talking always about ideas, about how to understand the world, how to make the world better, and how to really use deep logical analysis of the world to accomplish those goals. And people were so excited about finding new ways of thinking and sharing those new ways of thinking. When I bounced around a little after Chicago to a few other universities, but when I landed at the University of Rochester, I had the great good fortune to find exactly the same thing in the daily lunches I went to with the people in the department at Rochester. A lot of them have now departed for other places, but I was going to lunch every day with, I don't know how many of these names will mean anything to your listeners, but I was going to lunch every day with Alan Stockman and Mark Bills. Mark Bills is just a fantastically insightful guy who sees the world, can always be relied on to see the world in a way that is different from the way anybody else sees it. Alan and Mark, and then some of the younger guys, John Boyd, Ken McLaughlin, Jim Kahn. We had Marvin Goodfriend visiting for a year. It was the most lively, brilliant group of people I could ever have hoped to visit with. And every day we took a 2-hour lunch and figured out how the world worked. And it went on for many, many years. And it was a glorious, glorious part of my life.
So for those who haven't read about this, why don't we give them just a little bit more? I mean, if you have a specific example you want to recount, that works, or just in general, like what do you mean? Like somebody would just sit down and be like, guys, I've been thinking about this and help me out here. I'm getting stuck. This, you know, there's a paradox. And like, it was that sort of thing or
yeah. What? Like, hey guys, how come at the ballpark they price the seats so the fancy seats sell out before the bleachers sell out? Why do the box seats sell out before the bleachers do? Why did they set the prices that way? And then we were off and running for talking about all the possible motivations for that. One of them may be that you really want those box seats to sell out. Otherwise, people will try and sneak into the empty box seats. I think that was probably the best answer that got offered. Sometimes it was much more complicated than that. Sometimes it was much simpler.
This is great. All right. So let me stop you. And because, again, I just want to make sure for the casual. Or plus, we got people, remember, Steve, who are driving or they're on the treadmill or whatever. They're about to do their personal best on the treadmill. And so maybe they missed the brilliance there. So the way these things would work is you've got a bunch of smart people sitting around. And so a lot of times I'm sure the layperson would think, well, gee, the answer is obvious. And then, but you say, well, no, and then you'd be able to bat that down. So the puzzle you're trying to explain. So the empirical fact is you're saying the real expensive box seats at baseball stadiums would tend to sell out such that even at their high price, there's none available, even though you could always go get, you know, pay the low ticket price for sitting way up in the bleachers. And so at first glance, that might be puzzling because you're thinking, well, gee, clearly if they sold out, they could have charged a little bit more.
Exactly. If they sold out, they could have charged a little bit more. Why didn't they do that? In my recollection, the best answer we were able to come up with was that they're afraid that if they don't sell them out, then people will buy bleacher seats and try to sneak into those empty box seats. But again, that doesn't capture it because then people, of course, object to why that can't be the right explanation, and people object to the objections and object to the objections. Right. And it's all this rapid fire stuff going around the table with 12 very smart people picking holes in each other's stories. I've tried to capture some of that in some of the books I've written. When I wrote The Armchair Economist, which was my first book, it was all inspired by those lunch conversations and trying to catch the spirit of them.
Well, yeah, there's one in there. By the way, let me stop and say for the folks at home. So The Armchair Economist, when I was recently asked, shoot, I forget what the name of the, I'll put a link in the show notes page, folks, but I can't remember the exact name of the website, but this guy asked me to, it was an economics themed website, and he asked me to pick, I think, three books to recommend. And I think I picked Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money, Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, and Steve Landsberg's book, The Armchair Economist. And I had to give a blurb to explain, this is why you should read this book. And this, the guy running this promotional thing or whatever for his readers, I think he asked two others or three other people and someone else of just listing three books out of any possible books, you know, that have been written ever. Also picked Steve's book, The Armchair Economist, as one of his three that he would give to somebody to say, this is your starting book in economics. So that's pretty good indication. And also because Steve is not an Austrian. He's coming out of the Chicago school tradition. So that should show you if I'm saying, no, there's a lot of stuff in here you don't want to miss, go ahead and check that out. And so in there, Steve, one that just jumps to mind is the stuff about why do movies charge so much for popcorn? And just to give a flavor, folks, of the kind of back and forth. So, you know, the layperson would say, what are you kidding me? Why do movie theaters charge so much for popcorn? Well, because they can. And then you can say, oh, okay, well, then how come they don't charge you an extra $2 to use the bathroom? I mean, once you pay your ticket fee and you're inside the theater and you got to go, you know, they have a monopoly and they could really rake you over the coals. But you know, you realize, well, wait a minute, if they were charging you to use the bathroom, well, then maybe they couldn't charge as much for the ticket. And so it just, that's the kind of thing where a lot of the immediate man on the street answers, the economist can say, well, wait a minute. No, that can't be quite it, because if that were the case, you'd see such and such, and you don't see that.
Yeah, that is a great example. Another one that occurred to me while we were talking before about the lunch conversation, Ken McLaughlin came in with this one to lunch one day, and I ended up talking about it in The Armchair Economist. He's concerned about the fact that often in a large corporation, an employee will come up with an idea that can save the company a lot of money. What's his incentive to run with that idea? Well, pretty small usually. especially if he's not being completely monitored, if people don't realize you're doing something privately at your desk, which is making the company run a whole lot better. People don't always see that you're doing that. You don't get rewarded for it. How can companies get people to care more about improving the company's bottom line? One way is to have them hold stock in the company, but that doesn't really work because if you hold 0.0001% of the stock in the company, then you get 0.0001% of the reward for the dollar that you save them. That's not much of an incentive. But Ken said, you know, it works if every employee receives as his salary the full profits of the company. If the company makes $50 billion, then every employee gets $50 billion. And that way, if you save the company a dollar, that's an extra dollar in your own pocket. You've got all the right incentives. And of course, the immediate response is, where are they going to get the money if they make $50 billion to pay $50 billion to each of 1,000 employees? And the answer to that is, well, you have them buy their jobs in advance. You pay about $50 billion for the privilege of working there. And then at the end of the year, you receive a salary of $50 billion plus something. And that salary is equal to the entire profit of the company. Now, most, you ask, why don't they do that? And most laymen at that point will say, well, it's obvious why they won't do that, because it's obviously ridiculous. But then you ask exactly what's ridiculous about it. And it turns out that all of the obvious things that are ridiculous about it are things for which Ken was able to suggest a workaround. And one by one, we sort of started paring away all these reasons why this thing would, quote, obviously, unquote, not work. And he kept shooting us down and saying, actually, that's a problem they could solve if they wanted to, and here's how they could do it. And so it became a huge puzzle to take this thing that seemed obviously ludicrous on its surface and try to explain why it was ludicrous, or at least maybe it's not ludicrous, but at least why it doesn't happen, why we don't see people doing it. And, you know, to me, it was so much fun to discover that something that initially strikes you as not even worth talking about turns out that in order to analyze it, you got to come up with a lot of really insightful ideas. And, well, and again, the details of that are maybe too much to go into in a podcast where you don't have some pages in front of you to keep track of all the various ins and outs. But I did write that up in the Armchair Economist, and it was a very typical example of the kind of lunch conversation that always made my eyes light up.
Well, along the lines of something that at first it might not seem like it's worth even discussing because it's so obvious, but then you end up knowing this, the problem or the nature of the issue much better after you talk it through. We got to bring up the staircase one. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
The escalators and the staircases?
Right.
And this one I talk about in my new book, which is Can You Outsmart an Economist? Why do people stand still on escalators, but not on stairs? If I go to the department store, I see people on the stairs, they're all walking. I see people on the escalator, some of them are walking and some of them are standing still. Why do they take their breaks on the escalator and not on the stairs? Now, the obvious reason is that if you stand still on the stairs, you never get anywhere. And most people, I think, are happy to dismiss the issue with that and walk away shaking their heads and wondering why anybody would ever have had to ask the question in the first place.
Thank God I didn't go into economics.
But the fact
guys is,
people on the escalator rest for a finite amount of time. They rest for a minute or two while they're on the escalator. You could take your 1 or 2 minute rest on the stairs and then move along, and you would get where you're going. You would get where you're going a little slower, but standing still on the escalator also means you'll get where you're going a little slower. So it's not obvious if you're going to take a 2 minute rest, if you're on escalators part of the day, on stairs part of the day, at some point you want to take a 2 minute rest. Why do you always take it on the escalator and not on the stairs? The obvious answers to that, many of the obvious answers to that are not right. And again, I will refer people to the book. I'll take this as an opportunity rather than give the full answer to encourage people to go buy my new book. And I'll mention the title again. It's Can You Outsmart an Economist? But in there, I explain why this is actually a pretty interesting problem. And I have watched rooms full of very smart people, economists and mathematicians, tear their hair out over this once they have realized how interesting and difficult a problem it is. I also think I now know the answer, and the answer is in the book. I won't spoil it for your readers who might want to try and figure it out for themselves. The answer is in the book, but none of the simple, obvious answers are correct. And you learn a lot when you take the simple, obvious answers and start picking them apart and seeing why they're not correct.
And by the way, this is one where, again, I'm not going to say more because I don't want to spoil it. I do, and yes, everybody, you should get Steve's new book, and we'll talk about that at the end of this interview as well. But I disagreed with your I thought you guys missed the obvious. When I say obvious, I mean even for an economics approach answer, and the way also for those listening, the good way they motivate it, and especially if you're an economics professor, you know, if you've got undergrads in particular, and once you're teaching marginal analysis, it's a good little puzzle just to get them thinking about it. Because when you break it down into marginal analysis, then the paradox really jumps out at you. Because then if you say, you know, in other words, Steve's right, the man on the street is going to think, well, gee, if you stand still on the escalator, eventually you're going to get there, whereas the stairs you're not. So duh, I can't believe we're having this conversation. But if you break it down into marginal analysis and just say, what is the marginal benefit and the marginal cost of taking one step, then it really becomes difficult to see, well, gee, why should it, you know, if it makes sense to take one step, if the marginal benefit of getting one foot closer to my goal is worth the calories or whatever, however you want to quantify the cost on the staircase, well, then why doesn't that follow on this on the escalator as well?
That's exactly how I would explain it to an economics student. The less precise but probably more palatable way to say it for a non-economics student is simply that a two-minute rest on the stairs is going to get you where you're going a little slower. A two-minute rest on the escalator is going to get you where you're going a little slower. And so when you look at it like that, there is a symmetry that makes you wonder why you make different choices in the two cases.
Yeah, and actually, I don't think you had that angle in when, because you wrote this up for like Slate or something, right?
I did, and I did not word the question that way there. I wish I had.
But, I was going to say that sounds harder to knock down than the way you worded it on Slate. So
when I wrote it up again for Can You Outsmart an Economist, I think I wrote it up a lot better. I think, you know, people reading who were baffled by my old Slate column might find the chapter in the new book more comprehensible.
Okay, well, very good. That's excellent then. Okay, well, we've sort of warmed people up with the, well, you know what? Let me hit one last thing here on the Chicago tradition, because I've noticed this. People who came from Chicago or UCLA, they have, like, when they leave the it seems like the price theory class, and I think that's what they call it. Did they call that at Chicago?
Yes, absolutely.
They had this tool, but it seems to, like, I didn't have anything like that at NYU. And I've talked to other students who have, you know, gotten PhDs in economics at different school. And we're all sort of lamenting. And in fact, at the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech, we're having Deirdre McCloskey come. This is going to be in early 2019. And she's coming to give, you know, like a quick crash course in price theory to give a flavor to our students of that.
And not just your students, because I'm sending four of my best students down to Texas to be part of that.
Oh, okay, great. All right, excellent. That's it shows that I wasn't involved in that part of the discussion. I didn't even know that. All right, well, good. So can you – just for outsiders who don't know what we're talking, can you give a flavor of, you know, what do I mean, this tradition of the price? Because again, that's maybe you don't fully appreciate it, that's not something that's just part of any economics PhD curriculum. Like the tools and the way they had you, I've seen you do it on your blog, the way you break stuff down. Like once you do it, I can see what you're saying. I say, oh yeah, but I never would have thought of looking at it like that. And I suspect a lot of that just from the training you got at Chicago.
The Chicago price theory tradition is, it's a little hard to break it down into a few words, but it's a tradition of taking extremely seriously the notion that human behavior is directed toward goals. That if you see people doing things that appear not to make sense, your first guess should not be that it's because they're stupid. Your first guess should be it's because you don't understand what they're trying to accomplish. And that if you could understand what they're trying to accomplish, you would understand why they're doing what they're doing. Thinking about what goals could lead to the behavior that you're seeing, and then in particular thinking about how different people with different goals will adopt behaviors that not only advance their own goals, but also help them navigate a world in which these other people are interacting with them in ways that advance those other people's goals, breaking all this down into simple logical steps and saying that if this person is trying to accomplish this, he'll do that. And if he does that, then that will change the environment for this other person. And if this other person faces that environment, he's going to want to try and do this. And therefore, he's going to take this strategy. And given that he's taking that strategy, this other person is going to be affected by that and want to try to do some other thing. And very carefully, logically laying out the steps, making simplifying assumptions, not being afraid to make simplifying assumptions, coming back later if you need to revisit those assumptions, but making enough simplifying assumptions so that you can analyze the problem and actually get to a concrete answer. You learn something along the way. It might or might not be right because your simplifying assumptions might or might not have been right, but you learn a lot more that way than you do by floundering around and trying to develop an all-encompassing model that is so general that you can't do anything with it. That's the Chicago tradition. That's what I was brought up in there, and I have found it a very satisfying way to see the world.
And I wonder, tell me if this rings true to you, and if not, I'm not trying to lead you with this. I'm genuinely asking. I'm curious your answer. It seems to me that the people coming out of the Chicago and the UCLA tradition, with those armed with those tools, you take that framework more seriously than I think the average neoclassical economist takes his or her models. And the anecdote here, and you know, this is probably apocryphal, but it sounds valid to me that the story goes that, you know, there's some new Keynesian economist or whatever at a Harvard or something, and he gets a job offer from somewhere else. And, you know, it's a little bit more money, but the school's less prestigious and he's weighing the, he didn't have to go to but maybe he likes the city better and he's weighing the pros and cons and he brings his colleague in and he's trying to decide. And the colleague says, well, shouldn't this be real easy? Just, you know, write out your utility function and then just maximize it subject to your budget constraint. And then the guy says, come on, this is serious. And, you know, and that's I think the, you know, to capture that they don't really believe these models that they teach their students. This is just something they do in their day job and then they punch out and then they think about stuff the way anybody else does. Whereas I feel that like Milton Friedman and Steve Landsberg and guys like that, like you really walk around going through life, seeing things differently from how others do.
I buy that. And I'll give you an example. I think that goes to the heart of the point that you're making. I have in front of me, and while you were talking, I pulled this up on my screen. I have in front of me some final exam questions from the microeconomics courses at Chicago and MIT in the 1960s when Milton Friedman was teaching microeconomics at Chicago and Paul Samuelson was teaching microeconomics at MIT, two great, great economists, two of the greatest economists of the 20th century. The problems from Samuelson's final exams, they sound like this. Write a 45-minute essay explaining what Hicks does in books 1 and 2 of Value and Capital, relating the parts to each other. Or, in 45 minutes, discuss the principal theories relative to capital and interest. Or, in 45 minutes, state the fundamental problems of bilateral monopoly. Friedman's questions, I'm going to read them right off here. Will a specific tax of $1 per cup of coffee raise the price of coffee by more or less than an equivalent tax equal to a specified percentage of the price? In other words, he was asking, will the price of coffee go up by more if you tax it at $1 per cup or if you tax it at 10% per cup, assuming that 10% of a cup is a dollar? True or false? Technological improvements in the production of rayon and nylon have tended to raise the price of meat. True or false, if soybean farmers receive a subsidy of a fixed number of dollars per acre, the yield per acre will fall. Friedman really trying to get you to think seriously about the real world in a way that Samuelson is not. And again, great economists, great teachers, great contributors, but very different ways of very different styles of thinking.
And also, I mean, maybe this is implicit in what you were just saying there, Steve, but and of course, I'm actually pleasantly surprised by Samuelson's questions because they hit on stuff that I'm interested in doing, you know, my own work, the history of economic thought and particular capital interest theory. But I think maybe what you were getting at there is Samuelson was asking, parrot back to me, what did other great economists say about these issues? Whereas Friedman's trying to get you to think what would happen in the real world if we did this.
Bingo. And again, just pulled up another, I'm looking at these Friedman things here. I can't resist quoting you another one. Question off Milton Friedman's final. Should General Motors instruct its subsidiaries to buy parts wherever they can get them the cheapest, or should they favor other General Motors subsidiaries? Great question. Again, very, very different style of question. And you're absolutely right. Samuelson was asking, what have you read? Prove to me that you've read it. Prove to me that you've digested it. Friedman was saying, think a little bit outside the box here. See what you can do with the ideas that you've digested and see how you can apply them in a new situation. But I just have to say, Bob, and it's not really relevant to anything, but when you were telling your story about the guy making the job choice and he had a less well-paying job at a more prestigious institution, I thought you were going to tell a different story, and it's a story that I heard from my friend Ed Cannell, who's a mathematician, and I was going to be very surprised because Ed tells this story about himself, and I was going to say, wow, you know Ed Cannell? but apparently your story was a different one. But Ed's story was that he was teaching at the University of Miami. This was a long time ago, and he was making $4,500 a year, which was a huge salary at the time. He got an offer from Rice, which was a much better department, for $3,000 a year. And after much agonizing, he decided he had to be in the more serious department. And so he went to Rice and he took the pay cut. And then a year later, he got an offer from Princeton for $2,300 a year. But Princeton was the world's center of mathematics at the time. So how could he possibly turn that down? And again, with just a little bit more agonizing, he went to Princeton and his salary had gone from $4,500 to $3,000 to $2,300. And when Ed tells that story, he says, whenever I think about that, he said, it always makes me want to ask people, if you're so smart, how come you're not poor?
I'm a little thrown though. Did you mean thousands or hundred?
I meant hundreds. This was a long time ago. Ed would be about, he must be in his 90s, I would think, by now. So this was a long time ago, and there's been a lot of inflation.
Huh. Wow. Okay. That's good. the Fed's really stuck it to us. That's interesting.
And no, wait, it's not just the Fed. I mean, academic salaries were much, much, much lower in his day than they were in ours, even in real terms.
Okay.
And especially in math, actually.
Steve, let's take a moment to let the folks know, how can they learn more about what I think about other economists and their contributions to economic thought? Well, the answer is clear. What you want to do is subscribe to Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Now, I'm just one of the lecturers there. There's a whole host of other contributors, and it's fantastic. But let me just talk about the things that I've contributed, namely my two courses on the history of economic thought. So the first course starts with the classical economists, and it goes through the subjective marginal revolution. The second course basically covers 20th century economics. So to give you an idea of the sorts of things you'll find here, and I hope, by the way, that my conversation here with Steve Landsberg has opened up some of your eyes to things that are available beyond just what the Austrians have written. So, of course, I'm a card-carrying Austrian economist. I think that they are the most important school of thought and have the best contributions, but there are other contributions that non-Austrians have made, and you should be aware of them if you want to be a well-rounded economics expert. So some of the things we cover in this My Liberty Classroom course is, for example, the marginal revolution. You've heard of it. You know that Karl Menger perhaps was one of the three pioneers who is credited, not just by Austrians, but by the profession at large, with ushering in the so-called marginal revolution. But what exactly was it? Well, you'll find out if you take my course on the history of economic thought. Also, you've heard people talk about the Coase theorem left and right, and you have a vague idea what it is. If that's all you've heard about it, I bet you don't really understand what the Coase theorem is. Whole lecture on that in the part two history of economic thought course that I give for Tom. Also, the Lucas critique, right? Named after Robert Lucas. You know, he had something to do with blowing up Keynesian economics. Maybe the stagflation of the 70s had something to do with it, but you don't really know exactly what it is. You just heard people talking about it. You're going to know exactly what it is. You take this class. Also, what about Eugen von Bombavirk? Besides having a killer beard and an unbelievably cool name, Eugen von Bombavirk, the reason he's great Of course, he was the great master in capital and interest theory, and he's a hero in the Austrian tradition. So I'm going to show you not only what he did, and also by explaining some of the critiques he made of previous thinkers, but what we're going to do, getting a little bit naughty, I'm going to show why I think Mises misunderstood what Bombavrik was saying, and that the famous critique that Mises gives in Human Action of Bombavrik is a little bit off the mark. And so this is really important, especially if you're a historian of economic thought, that I really wanted to get this down somewhere. It's in my doctoral dissertation, but that's admittedly difficult to read. But this is one spot where I explain why I think Mises and Frank Fetter misunderstood Bombavrik. All right. So again, if that's interesting to you and you want to get the inside scoop, you got to go listen to my lectures at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. My History of Economic Thought, Part 1, is where I talk about Bombavrik. Last thing, if you have been interested to hear Steve and me talk about formal economics and the sorts of things you can do with it, well, when I cover Arrow's impossibility theorem, that's in Part 2 of my series, then not only do I explain it in words and, you know, basic intuitive concepts, tell you sort of, hey, this is what Arrow did, and I talk about the theorem, I also have a technical lecture where we literally prove the theorem, because this is one area where it's great that it's an incredibly powerful, unexpected result. When you see the seemingly innocuous assumptions that Arrow makes and then the incredibly sweeping conclusion he can prove with them, it's astonishing. And the great thing about it is the particular proof we're going to go over, which is actually developed by this guy called Sen, a different economist. It's not the way Arrow himself proved it. It's remarkably simple. You don't need a background in calculus or anything. I can just show you using symbolic logic. You don't need to have anything really sophisticated in your toolbox. You can follow the proof if you're willing to just sit there for a half an hour and have me walk you through it. And again, when you're done, you're really going to understand it. And this is an area where it really helps to go through the proof, not just to show you the power of formal analysis, but also because so many people, not just economists, but other social scientists, allude to, oh yeah, Arrow's theorem. And a lot of times they don't really know what they're talking about, right? Whereas here, if you go through and you've actually seen the proof of it, you're going to know exactly what Arrow was saying. And then you can evaluate whether this other person knows what he or she is talking about. So lots more stuff involved, packed into these History of Economic Thought courses that you can get at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The last thing, if you take away nothing else from this little promo I'm giving here, I want it to be this: that you use my link when you go to it, because otherwise, you know, we're just going to have an increasing concentration of income inequality. Why have Tom Woods have all the fun? I don't see why that would happen. So what you want to do, if you're going to go peruse and look at the different deals that Tom has and so forth, for the different levels of membership, what you do is go to bobmurphyshow.com/classroom. Then that's going to redirect you. Don't worry. You're going to think it got lost and it lost me. No, it knows. The browser knows everything. Just go to bobmurphyshow.com/classroom and then go ahead and look at Tom's site and see what you want. And again, the good thing is going to be my History of Economic Thought courses plus all the other great stuff. Now let's get back to my conversation with Steve. So let me switch gears a little here, Steve, just to this isn't all just pointy-headed stuff that wouldn't interest a layperson. You actually got into some controversy, and I'm referring to the Sandra Fluke episode, where it ended up, you wrote something on your blog. By the way, what's the name of your blog? What's the URL for your blog for people who want to go there?
TheBigQuestions.com, TheBigQuestions.com. I used to blog every day. Now I've slowed down a lot, and it's once a week at best, but there's a lot of old material there, and if you're coming for the first time, there's plenty to keep you busy for a very long time. TheBigQuestions.com.
Yeah, and it's sort of like it's a special treat now when you do put up a new post, and I check it once in a while, and I say, oh, Steve has a new post up. It's great. And so you wrote something that ended up being very controversial, and you even had like students picketing your classes. I mean, this was the full nine yards of...
Well, what I wrote wasn't controversial. What they said I wrote was perhaps controversial.
Sandra, there we go. All right, so tell us the story in as much detail as you want.
Sandra Fluke was a woman who was very much in the news for campaigning for subsidized contraception. I don't remember whether it was directly government subsidies to contraception or mandated private insurance for contraception, but essentially she wanted contraception to be subsidized, which is a respectable position, but she did not have a respectable argument. All of her arguments came down to saying that contraception is a good thing. She argued in great detail that contraception is a good thing and concluded that it should be subsidized. That is not an adequate argument because there are a lot of good things that nobody thinks should be subsidized. An argument for subsidizing is not the same as an argument for saying that something is good. Rush Limbaugh made this point on his show in a way that was very colorful. And through some convoluted logic, he ended up deciding that by making this argument, she was the equivalent of a slut. Slut was the word he used.
Can I jump in real fast just so people can see the connection? Because, yeah, she ultimately wanted others to subsidize her promiscuous lifestyle. That's where Rush was coming from, and that's why he used that term.
Something like that. I don't remember what his logic was. It was colorful. It was, I thought, detracted from the point that he was really trying to make. And I blogged to defend the point he was making. In the blog, I also said that slut is the wrong word here. I said that even by Limbaugh's own logic, prostitute would have been a better word than slut, but that's also the wrong word. If you want a negative word to describe what she's doing, the best one I can think of is extortionist, in the sense that she is demanding that other people cough up money to support her pet causes. But I also said that the word that you use here is not what's relevant. What's relevant is the intellectual point that she doesn't have a case, and Rush Limbaugh is exactly right about that. Somehow, this was picked up by the popular press, and what was reported was that I had defended Rush Limbaugh's use of the word slut. And then a whole lot of people who read those accounts and obviously never read my blog decided that I had either defended Rush Limbaugh calling her a slut or I had called her a slut, and this was outrageous behavior on my part. And so people were very upset and angry, and it was springtime and people were looking for an excuse to get outside and march and have protests. So there was some brouhaha over that. I think an interesting side note to that story is that in my blog posts, not just the first one, it was actually a series of blog posts, I made her case for her. I went out of my way to say, here is the case that you would make if you did want to argue for subsidizing birth control. What's the best possible case we can make for subsidizing birth control? And I made what I thought was a pretty good case for her conclusion. I'm not sure it was a convincing case, but I think I made a pretty good case for it, where she made no case at all. So if anything, the people on that side should have been grateful to me. I was giving them the arguments that they could have used that might have actually convinced some thoughtful people, as opposed to the arguments they were trying to use. Again, it was all a great deal of silliness. It was a bunch of very silly people complaining about something that they had not read, did not understand, and it was, you know, fortunately there were no significant consequences.
But it did get to the point where you actually had people protesting your classes.
Yeah, there were people protesting my classes. But again, it was springtime. Students will do silly
right.
things.
I'm just curious, like, as in they just stood outside with signs, or they literally, like,
no,
did they interfere with
my, recognition? My recollection is that a row of 14 of them came and stood silently in the front of my classroom. They did not stop me from teaching, but they stood behind me while I taught silently, and somehow this was supposed to be registering their protest.
Now, is it possible that they just didn't know that the marginal benefits of stepping outside your room exceeded the cost of the
I think these were probably students who were not terribly swift in a whole lot of ways.
Okay. So let me, now that I have you, I mean, I have to say, I think this is the kind of thing where someone who's just listened to you talking with me for an hour and can see where you come and how precise you are and how you like to think things through. And if you're the sort of person that would sit there and spend an hour at lunch talking about why do you stand still on escalators but not stairs, that you saying, well, no, gee, Rush shouldn't have used that word. He should have used it. I think someone can hear you and be, you know, totally get it. Whereas, not that it makes it right, but can you, stepping back, see how if someone didn't know your personality and was primed by the media accounts and then went to your post would quote see that you were a monster? Or do you still think that, no, that's completely crazy, I can't believe anybody was upset by this?
I think most of these people never read the post because I ended up doing a lot of media over this, and time after time after time, the people who were interviewing me on the radio and on television were asking me, why did you choose to use the word slut? Whereas the blog post says, this is the wrong word. Russ should never have used it. So it's crystal clear that they had never, ever read the post that they were complaining about.
That reminds me, did you hear the one about when some feminists started protesting Richard Feynman? Do you know this story, Steve?
I'm not sure I do.
Okay, so he was trying to get across some point about special relativity, and so he would tell this anecdote about there's the woman driver, and she's going, and then the cop pulls her over and comes up and starts interrogating, like, do you know how fast you were going, ma'am? That kind of stuff. And it's kind of a clever joke to, you know, apparently she was driving near the speed of light. You get the idea. And so, like, to say, do you know how fast you were driving? And I clocked you going this, you know, that sort of thing. Somehow, I don't remember the details, but Feynman was just using it as an interesting way to motivate the weird stuff that happens when you get close to the speed of light. And, you know, you got to be in the relativistic frames and so forth, inertial frames and whatever. And so somehow the feminists, you know, the students on campus who were into that stuff really got outraged and were like, had signs saying Feynman, sexist pig and stuff like that. And because they were saying he was, you know, playing to, you know, and so he the next lecture was engaging some of these protests, like, what's the problem? And they were saying, because you're engaging in stereotypes that, you know, women are bad drivers and that, the male authority figure of the police. And this is the way he tells the story. And I think Feynman was famous for embellishing the tale, so maybe this didn't happen. But the way he tells it is, he says, what are you talking about? I never said the police officer was a man. You just assumed that. So that was pretty good. So anyway, that was, if that's true, that sounds like in your situation where, besides just the whole thing being a little bit, you know, where you were trying to mostly just teach an economics point and use something provocative to, you know, colorful to get people's attention, and that they were accusing you of doing something that, you know, you literally didn't do. Well, in any event, I am still going to say, Steve, that you should have, I'm not blaming the victim, but you should have known if you wrote that people were going to freak out. I'm going to say that.
Well, I there's nothing I could do about that.
All right, fair enough. Not that you should, but okay. Another thing, just a little color here. Can you tell us a little bit? So background, folks, is that when I grew up in Rochester, and then I was going home. I forget why I was going. This was for like a high school reunion or something. There was some reason I was going back to Rochester, and then Steve heard I was. And so I went over, and you showed me the Ariel Silks, and it was very embarrassing for me because I like could barely get my body upright in that thing. And so, whereas you were doing like Batman stuff.
With a couple of weeks practice, Bob, I could have you up there. Another couple of weeks, I could have you dropping from the ceiling. I love doing Ariel Silks. I will, just for the benefit of your listeners, I will post do you have a website where you put links relevant to the podcast?
Yes. Yeah. While the listeners are here, it's going to be at bobmurphyshow.com/6 is where you're going to get links to all the stuff we're talking about.
All right. Then I will send you a link, which you can put on there where people can see me doing the Ariel Silks. It's a wonder for people who don't know what it is. It's like what you see in Cirque du Soleil, where you've got fabric hanging from the ceiling. You climb up the fabric, you wrap yourself in it in certain ways. And then you let go and you fall from the ceiling to the floor, and the silk unwraps and it catches you before you actually land. So that at least if you've wrapped right, it catches you before you actually land. And it's a great way to get exercise. I've been doing it for several years. I am not nearly as good at it now as I used to be. I'm not sure whether that's because I practice less or whether it's because I'm aging, but I've dropped back from what they call level 5 to level 3. And I seem to be plateauing at level 3. I'm not sure I will ever work my way back up to level 5 again, but it's great exercise, and I encourage people to do it.
And how did you get into that?
I got into it because I had a lot of friends who are into it. And I'll tell you, this is a fascinating story to me. I have the two friends who first got into it and then talked all of my other friends into it were a married couple, both computer programmers. They were on vacation in Hawaii. They had never seen anything like this before, but they went to a performance and they saw people doing this. And at least as they tell the story, or at least as I remember them telling the story, for the second time today, I'll say I know that human memories are not always accurate, but my best memory of the way they tell the story is that they walked out of that performance and they both spontaneously and simultaneously turned to each other and said, let's quit our jobs and just do that. And they did. They built a rig in their backyard and they went out and they do it for hours and hours every day. And they also do some freelance programming when they need money. But they've made it largely a full-time pursuit and they are absolutely phenomenal at what they do. And they inspired a lot of my friends to do it. And then all my friends were doing it. So, of course, I had to do it too.
Now, did all your friends quit their jobs also?
No, I think they're the only ones who quit their jobs.
I was going to say that even a Chicago school economist would have trouble rationally explaining, you know, that. But that's so, yeah. And again, I know for people just hearing us talk about it, you know, like, wait, but you should watch the video. We'll post it at bobmurphyshow.com/6. But I saw Steve was doing incredible stuff, and it's a lot harder than it looks in the sense I couldn't even get going. Like, it was.
But
it was really tricky.
I've been around a lot of novices, Bob, and I'll tell you that most of them, the first time they try, cannot even get off the ground. They're right where you were, and yet within 3 weeks, they're doing impressive stuff.
Well, fortunately, I never did it for 3 weeks, so we'll never know. But no, I do want to try it again sometime. It did look very invigorating what you were able to do. Well, why don't we at this point just real briefly, because I think it might be of interest to some people just to know what, you know, what's the, how does this, these things happen that you and I currently are sharing email notes back and forth about what's called the tax interaction effect. And so the hope is that, you know, maybe we'll get a publishable paper out of this, but just for those, maybe grad students or just, you know, outsiders who are just curious, like, you know, these people, they start collaborating and they how does that happen? So do you want to just tell the quick version of the story and how did it end up that something I've been kind of dabbling in, well, not dabbling, I've been writing about trying to communicate this result to a broader audience for years. And then for some reason, this my most recent pass, you had first thought I was wrong, right? And then
You had some blog posts about this and roughly, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is a fair rough statement of the issue. If a coal miner digging coal out of the ground ultimately causes global warming because the coal that he digs out of the ground is going to get burned and is going to contribute to the carbon in the atmosphere. And if we can say that a coal miner, by working for an hour, causes $4 worth of damage to the environment, then what we would expect our freshman economics students to say is that that coal miner's labor should be taxed at $4 an hour. Labor in a coal mine, there should be an extra tax of $4 an hour for working in a coal mine because it creates this, what we call an externality. What you're pointing out, partly, I think, is that miner's labor is already taxed pretty highly, and we should take that into account when we're deciding how much additional tax we want to levy on him. And also, this question becomes much more complicated when we start thinking about the fact that lots of other things in the economy are taxed. That creates all kinds of distortions. So we are not starting from a first, what you would want to do starting from a first best tax system is not the same as what you want to do starting from an imperfect tax system. And so we want to take into account the existence of all the other taxes before we decide how much we want to tax the externality. Some of the things you said on your blog post initially struck me as wrong. So I sat down and scribbled some equations to see if you were wrong, and my equations convinced me that you were probably right. And so I ended up sending you an email acknowledging that, and we had a little email back and forth, and we've both been thinking about it a little more since then, and I've spent my last few days scribbling down some equations, and I also have engaged in my bad habit of sending you more emails than I should to report my latest insight. That's not a great idea because often my latest insight 10 minutes later, I've realized is wrong. So I should email you less, and I'm trying to do that. But eventually, I think, before very long, you and I between us are going to understand this substantially better than we do. Now, at that point, with these things, the question always becomes, okay, have we just figured out something that everybody else in the world understood except us anyway? Or have we figured out something that a lot of people would benefit from having explained to them? And I think we're not yet at the point where we're facing that question, but at the moment, we're just trying to understand it a little better ourselves.
Yes, exactly. And I didn't want to put words in your mouth, but I was hoping you were going to say, because that's what I personally liked about it, was that you emailed me and said, you know, at first when I read it, I was sure you were wrong. And then I went to go, but then I thought about it some more. And then, yes, I like when that happens. And incidentally, that was what happened with me with that debate, you know, the debt debate stuff with Krugman. I originally thought Krugman was right. And when Nick Rowe in Canada and Don Boudreau at GMU were saying Krugman was wrong, I was actually, folks, I promise you this is true, I was getting ready to reluctantly chime in and write a blog post saying, no, guys, Krugman's right on this. And then it was just in Nick Rowe, though, he had some simple, you know, simple models with two goods and two periods or whatever. And I just sat down to show Nick why he was wrong. And then I was like, well, wait a minute. And then, it, you know, about a day later, I was just walking around in a stupor because my whole world had turned upside down because I realized he was right. So anyway, that's it, not that, that hopefully Steve wasn't just stuck at the bottom of an escalator or anything like that. But he it was a nice thing when that happens, when you're sure you're thinking of it one way. Also, just to clarify, everything you said was correct in your retelling of what the issue is about. But more specifically of relevance, the way I've been using it in the carbon tax debate is economists will acknowledge there's other taxes, and this sounds super intuitive, and they'll say, wait a minute, right now the government's taxing labor and saving, you know, in terms of the income tax on wages and interest and profits and capital gains. So it's taxing good things. You know, they got to raise revenue somehow, and they're taxing things that we want people to do. We want people to work. We want people to save and invest, or at least there's a sense in which we don't want to penalize it arbitrarily. And yet, you know, assuming the global warming, blah, 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 and let's rule out Coasean solutions, then, okay, negative externality, put a tax on that. If we're going to discourage something by taxing it, you'd think of that. And so a lot of economists say, hey, I don't care whether Al Gore is right or wrong, that surely it can't hurt. It's got to be a move in the right direction to tax carbon, at least at a modest amount, and then dollar for dollar, we use that revenue to reduce these other distortionary taxes. And it turns out that there's cases in which you would want to levy a smaller carbon tax than what the negative externality demands, the more distortionary the pre-existing taxes are. And that's very counterintuitive. You would think, if anything, it'd be the other way around. And yet it turns out that this is the literature, folks. This isn't me just grasping at straws because I don't like a carbon tax. This is what the standard literature from economists who are pro-carbon tax say in their general equilibrium results. And so Steve and I are just trying to figure out what's driving this, like intuitively what's going on. Because it is, even when these economists themselves explain why they get the answer they do, a lot of times it's not very satisfying. Like, because that logic seems like it could prove all sorts of stuff that you think, surely that can't be right.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing that you can actually settle these things by thinking about them. Ultimately, I think all these equations we're scribbling around are going to clarify the issues, and we're going to understand them better. Now, again, whether that's a contribution to human knowledge, I don't know, because it may be that everybody in the world already does understand this stuff except us. But it will at least contribute to my understanding. And it's a great and wonderful thing that you can spend a week scribbling a bunch of equations, and at the end, you really understand something that you didn't understand before. Just a personal note here. I've been working very hard on this, but I am giving an exam in 5 days, and it usually takes me about 5 days to create an exam. It's a full-time job for me. I really slave over creating exams. So I'm afraid I'm going to be stepping aside from this project for the week, and then hopefully getting back to it next weekend.
Well, good. That'll give me a chance to catch up then, so I don't feel like the lazy guy in the duo here. Let me also just mention, I know we have a lot of purist Austrians listening. Oh, you mean equations, Murphy? You're going to let him say? At the very least, this stuff, it sharpens your way of thinking about it. Just like, for example, you know, if you're going to do free trade and you want to explain the logic of comparative advantage to someone, there's no way you can really get the person to see it unless you do a specific numerical example. And, oh, England makes wine and sweaters and France does the same and they can specialize in that. Without just doing a numerical example, you're really not going to see it. Okay. And so likewise with this stuff, yes, Steve and I are batting around, quote, unrealistic models of the economy and things like that. But it's to help isolate. You see the way it works in a real simple case, and then that can allow you to generalize the principle and see what's going on. So,
and there is the whole philosophy of Chicago price theory right there. You first see how it works in the real simple case, and that helps hone your intuition for understanding the much more complicated real world cases. The real world is not always as simple as the model. The real world does not always work out the same way the model does, but understanding the model it's a warm-up exercise. It helps hone your intuition. Then you can turn your intuition to the real world. When you think about the real world, you might get the opposite answer, but you will be thinking more clearly and you'll be thinking more effectively because you have practiced on an easier case.
And if anything, if at least allow you to see what's driving it. Like you can isolate and say, well, it's not this factor because that by itself would mean such and such. So it helps you rule things out. Okay, well, why don't we... we're getting near here to the time when I should let you go, but let me give you a chance to talk about, you know, your latest book, you know, explain what it is. And I don't know if you want to share one or two samples of what's in there. So, you know, why should people go buy this book?
Can You Outsmart an Economist? The book is called Can You Outsmart an Economist? It's a collection of brain teasers and puzzles that teach lessons about economics, teach lessons about how economists think, teaches lessons about how you can think and understand the world better. I'll give one example. And, you know, these are brain teasers, they're puzzles, and I give answers to them. And in some cases, I'm not absolutely sure that the answer is right, but I am sure that a lot of the obvious answers that other people give are wrong. And so with each puzzle, I give what I think is the right answer. In some cases, I acknowledge that I'm not sure. But then I also, in many cases, go through, here are the answers you might have given, and here's why they can't be the right answers. So I'll take one example, which I think gives the flavor of the whole book. There's a lot of data that show that beautiful college teachers, physically beautiful college teachers, get much higher evaluations from their students than ordinary-looking teachers do. Teachers who are handsome or beautiful get high evaluations. Other teachers who appear on paper to be exactly the same get much lower evaluations. How do you analyze that? Does that prove that students are superficial or that students are shallow in the way they evaluate their professors? The answer to that puzzle is that, in fact, the more beautiful teachers probably are better teachers. Probably the evaluations are accurate. And here's why. Beautiful people have a lot more career opportunities than ordinary looking people. Not only can they become models and actors, but they're more in demand in retail and in every profession where you have to deal with the public. So a beautiful person who goes into teaching on average is a person who turned down a lot of other opportunities in order to teach. On average, that's going to be a person who really loves teaching, and a person who really loves teaching is going to be really good at teaching. The ordinary person, again, on average, there are exceptions in all directions, but the ordinary looking person turned down a lot fewer opportunities, might have gone into teaching just because it was the best opportunity available, because there were no other choices. And those people, on average, are going to be less enthusiastic teachers. They're going to be less good at it. As I say in the book, if you show me a lighthouse keeper with movie star good looks, I will show you the world's best lighthouse keeper, because if he turned down a career in Hollywood to become a lighthouse keeper, he loves lighthouse keeping and he's going to be good at it. The more beautiful people in any profession where beauty doesn't matter, the more beautiful people on average are going to be the ones who are better. And again, that's the logic of economics, the logic of looking at opportunity costs, the logic of looking at incentives, the logic of looking at rational choice. And it's the logic that I try to bring out in the 150 or so puzzles in this book, which I hope people will have a lot of fun with.
That's excellent. And that will conclude our interview with the very handsome Steve Landsberg, who's also a good economist. And that shouldn't surprise us at this point. Steve, all joking aside, it's been a pleasure having you. And I'm sure the listeners have gotten a lot out of this conversation.
Thank you so much. And I'm just going to sneak in the name of the book again. It's Can You Outsmart an Economist? And people can read about it at outsmartaneconomist.com, outsmartaneconomist.com. That's all one word.
And remember, folks, to get that link and everything else that we've been talking about, including Steve's personal blog. Go to bobmurphyshow.com/6 for links to all these issues. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.